This is Culturetopia, with the week's very best arts reporting from National Public Radio. I am Netta Ulaby, reporter for NPR's Arts Desk.
And I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor for NPR's arts and entertainment blog, Monkey See.
Every week, we bring you our best cultural coverage, from books and music to movies, television, and everything in between.
And you can find links to all the stories we feature each week at npr.org/culturetopia. This week,
my secret boyfriend, Matt Damon, teams up again with director Steven Soderbergh for their new movie, The Informant.
Latino comic and actor Joey Medina talks about the art of stereotypical humor.
And everybody's favorite Harvard symbologist returns in the latest novel from the author of The Da Vinci Code.
But first,
my other secret boyfriend, Neil Patrick Harris, hosted the Emmys last Sunday. And he was also nominated for Best Supporting Actor in a Comedy for his role in the series How I Met Your Mother. Maybe you can tell I'm just a little bit jealous of NPR's Elizabeth Blair. She did this profile of a man of many talents.
Remember Doogie Howser? That wholesome teenage doctor?
We'll know more after the x-rays. Why don't you take a seat in the waiting room while I take him to radiology?
Neil Patrick Harris wants you to move on. In 2004, Harris showed up in the stoner movie Harold and Kumar, playing a drugged-out guy named Neil Patrick Harris.
Come on, dudes, let's pick up some trim at a strip club.
The Doogie line always works on strippers.
For a while, he left Hollywood for Broadway. He was Lee Harvey Oswald in the dark musical The Assassins.
Wrapped him a handkerchief around his gun. Said nothing wrong about what I'd done. Summon of everything
and starred in the very risque Broadway version of Cabaret. Neil Patrick Harris says Cabaret is the most provocative thing he's done yet.
My hair was bleached blue-black, as were my eyebrows, my armpits, my happy trail. Can you say that, Morning Edition? Happy trail?
I can imagine it's rather jarring if people came to see you thinking they were coming to see a Doogie, you know, they're Doogie Howser fans.
Yes, I certainly changed their mind. They probably hated me when they left.
The anti-Doogie character Neil Patrick Harris is playing these days is the shameless, egomaniac horn dog, Barney Stinson, on the CBS sitcom How I Met Your Mother.
Suits are for the living. That's why when it's my time to RIP, I'm going out of this world the same way I came into it. Buck naked. Yeah. It's gonna be awesome. Open bar for the guys, open casket for the ladies. What up?
He has just added so much dimension to a character that on paper was really just a joke delivery system.
Carter Bays is the co-creator of How I Met Your Mother.
You can tell when he's on the set, he's really studied the script and really put thought into how to make it funny.
Barney's got a handful of catchphrases. What up? Awesome. Legendary. Suit up. Barney always wears a suit.
Marshall Erickson, suit up!
I'm birthday suiting up.
Law suit up!
Barney Stinson is a skirt chaser. Neil Patrick Harris is gay. Carter Bays.
There was the worry that we're presenting him as such a Lothario and such a womanizer that, you know, if he came out and the world finds out that Neil Patrick Harris is gay, that would somehow make it less funny. And I just, none of us ever thought that could be possible because, you know, it's Neil.
Now, I like how you captured Marshall's essence. Goofy and unburdened with wit. But me, I want something more regal. Something my progeny can look at and say, there stands Barnabas Stinson. He was wise and strong.
I don't think your sword will fit.
I get that a lot.
Barney's a hoot. I'm not a big strip club guy, and he loves the strip clubs, so we probably wouldn't hang out at night much.
Even if they wouldn't hang out together, Neil Patrick Harris loves Barney Stinson, and he brings everything he's learned about performing to the role. Neil Patrick Harris unexpectedly knocked it out of the ballpark when he hosted the Tonys this year, especially his closing number. As the show was happening, he and two writers were backstage, coming up with lyrics, summarizing who got what award, like the three young stars who won for the musical Billy Elliot.
And then right when the last award was announced, I ran through it a couple times. And they threw me on stage, and I looked at some teleprompters and crossed my fingers.
With heels as sore as poor Achilles, 3-2-2 wearing billies were such a winning sight. Tonight, all three won Tony, plus they hit
Neil Patrick Harris says for the Emmys this Sunday, he doesn't want to repeat what he did at the Tonys, but he says there will be plenty of singing and dancing. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
So, Linda, what did you think about how my boyfriend did at the Emmys?
Your boyfriend made you very proud at the Emmys,
Nana.
He really did. He was terrific. He started off with a musical number pretty similar to what happened at the end of the Tonys.
I know at home you've got A&E, ABC Stars and Biography, NBC, BET, Fox and Discovery, IFC, Spike TV, C-SPAN and TNT, AMC, History, Disney and QVC, CBS, PBS, TBS, and I guess CNN, TV and Showtime and Oxygen. Whatever floats your boat, can't you watch it later? Yeah, you potatoes at home.
It turned into quite a showcase for him because not only did he have this nomination for Best Supporting Actor in a Comedy, which he lost, but he also appeared in a videotaped skit based on Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog, the internet musical that he had appeared in. So overall, it was just a huge night for him.
Steven Soderbergh's new movie is adapted from a book by investigative journalist Kurt Eichenwald. It's about an executive who blew the whistle on a shady agribusiness conglomerate that was involved in a vast international price-fixing conspiracy. That whistleblower had his own secrets, and what he told the FBI was not always true. Matt Damon stars as that not-always-reliable whistleblower, Mark Whitaker, and the movie is maybe surprising for its archly comic tone.
Who did you tell?
What?
Who else did you tell about the raid?
Well, I had to tell my secretary. Guys, I'm the head of the bioproducts division. She has to know where to get in touch with me. I told her months ago. So all I said was, Liz, I'm doing some work with the FBI. I might be out of touch for a while. That's it. She had no idea about our case. I'm pretty sure I've mentioned the name Kathy Doherty a time or two. She is a trusted ally. Man, I didn't want her to be scared.
Why'd you do that, Mark? Well,
I trust her.
Matt Damon and Steven Soderbergh joined Terry Gross of WHYY's Fresh Air to talk about the film.
Steven Soderbergh, the movie starts with a disclaimer that says basically these characters are all composites, and the disclaimer ends with, so there. What's the so there supposed to be there for?
I stole that actually from a movie called Airplane that came out in 1980. At the very end of the crawl on the film,
they put that there
at the end. I've always wanted to steal it. And I that was a card that was going to be, in our case, at the end of the film. And I moved it up front because I really wanted to remind everyone that this was a true story, because at a certain point it becomes so absurd that I thought people might not remember that it was true.
So the so there was to remind us that it was true, not to remind us that you took liberties.
Yes, exactly. And also, it's kind of a mood setter.
Yeah, it sets the mood.
Well, speaking of the mood is ironic as opposed to investigative journalism. We're inside the character that Matt Damon plays, Mark Whitaker, inside his head. Why did you want to go for that ironic tone? And the book that it's based on is a straightforward investigative book.
Well, let's see. When the book reached us in 2001, I'd recently finished Aaron Brockovich, and Michael Mann's The Insider had come out in 1999. I think our sense was we needed to do something different. That just taking the standard approach wasn't really going to be exciting or fresh. And that's when we started thinking maybe we should try and do it as kind of a black comedy.
The character that you play, Matt Damon, who's based on a real character, Mark Whitaker, who was the whistleblower on ADM and a price-fixing conspiracy, once he decides to talk to the FBI and wear a wire, part of that process drives him crazy, but part of the process is really seductive to him because, you know, he's seen the movie, he's seen The Firm, he's watched the James Bond films, he kids that he's 0014 because he's twice as good as 007. Since you've been in a series of spy films, the Bourne Identity films, what was it like for you to play somebody who wants to be that character and isn't?
it was a lot of fun. It was you know, the opposite of doing the Bourne movies. I think it was always something that I thought was interesting about the character, that he did enjoy you know, he did see himself as embroiled in the middle of this, you know, this drama. And he did constantly refer to Michael Crichton novels. And the character actually became addicted to the movie The Firm and saw himself as Tom Cruise in The Firm. And he would go and, you know, he would tell his wife he was going one place and he'd go back to the multiplex and sit there and watch The Firm. So there is that aspect of the character that was that, you know, of him that he, that was enjoying the work that he was doing. But on the other hand, he was taking extraordinary risks. He was doing really courageous things, gathering all this evidence. But ultimately, his lawyer, the defense, one of the defenses they used was, look, these FBI agents go out and do undercover work, and they're trained for it, and they crack. And here's a guy with absolutely no training who went out there for 2.5 years and you know, obviously, when he was diagnosed as being bipolar, they realized that all of this pressure that he was under was just exacerbating that, and he started to deteriorate, you know, pretty quickly by the end.
You can hear the rest of the interview at npr.org/culturetopia.
And we'll stay in the realm of the comedic for a moment. You may remember Joey Medina as one of the stars of the original Latin Kings of Comedy, from performances in just about every major comedy club in the country, and from many appearances on TV.
I love Mexico. I love driving across, because you ever notice when you drive across, you got Mexican immigration checking us out? And I'm thinking, what if Fred, we're sneaking in technology? Ooh. You, senor with the laptop, get out of the car! It's not a laptop, it's an Etch-a-Sketch, look!
He's also an actor, writer, and a director, best known for his film El Matador. Medina talked with Neil Conan about how many comedians use stereotypes in their acts.
I think, unfortunately, you know, our land of the free and the freedom speech here really doesn't work that well in America. For the things I say on stage, you hear in radio would get in trouble, or people at their local job would get in trouble. And when you go see a comedian, you know, I do a lot of stereotypical joke and a lot of stereotypical humor, but it's all tongue-in-cheek and it's all fun. And like I say, like I tell people, I don't make fun of stereotypes. I actually celebrate the stereotype. Mm-hmm. Because there is a difference between people. When you, you know, if you wanted to go eat Chinese food, you're driving around, you're not going to go to a place that has a sombrero on it. You're going to go to a place that has some kind of Chinese writing or some kind of Chinese art on it. You're going to go, okay, that must be a Chinese restaurant. Let me go in there. And that's kind of what comedy is. And basically, to tell you the truth, everything I talk about can pretty much cover any kind of stereotype or any kind of you know, ethnic group. I remember I did a huge show one time where it was all kind of rednecks, you know. And I remember I did exact same material I do for all Latino crowds, except I just changed I changed the word Latino into redneck, and they loved it. And it was the same material. It was the same exact material. Nothing
now,
changed.
I've read that, for example, that if I were to tell the same joke you told in front of a Latino audience, I'd be ducking. People would be throwing things.
A little bit. It just depends on how you do it.
Same material. Well, but, you know, the fact is, because you are who you are, coming from where you are, from the Bronx and from Arizona.
I think it depends. No, not necessarily. I think it depends. I did a show called Latin Palooza, which I executive produced and produced, and I also was the host, which you could find on DVD, by the way, Latin Palooza by Joey Medina. On there, I have a white guy named Darren Carter, who does a lot of Latino humor. And nobody got upset, you know. He went on there as a Latino, and I called him a coconut, but a reverse coconut, because he's brown on the inside and white on the outside. But the thing is, I think people understand a joke is a joke. Mm-hmm. And thank God people understand that. And it's okay to laugh at someone else's expense, as long as no one really gets hurt or no one's feelings are really hurt. And when people get upset at comedians or radio hosts that say something that's a little off color, I get so upset. I'm like, this is the land of the free. We have freedom of speech. If you don't like what he said, don't listen to him next time. I think the majority of comedians who do curse on stage, pretty much that's just the way they speak. They're more casual, and they speak to the audience as though they were speaking to a group of their friends at their house. I myself, believe it or not, I'm trying to cut back on that because, one, you get more work. And you seem a little more intelligent when you don't necessarily have to curse.
You know something else that's really freaking divisive in our culture?
What?
The Da Vinci Code.
Ah, yes, the Da Vinci Code. It certainly is. Cannot argue with that.
Love it or hate it. And Dan Brown has a new novel. Dan Brown wrote The Da Vinci Code. And in it, Harvard symbologist Robert Langdon gives a crash course on the number 33. It involves Pythagoras, Genesis, Joseph, Jesus, Islam, and the Masons. They're all in there, and they're in there throughout the entire book. It's called The Lost Symbol, and Dan Brown discussed it with NPR's Robert Siegel.
Robert Langdon is somebody who keeps on bumping into these hidden secrets, this lost wisdom, but he doesn't exactly believe in them, I gather.
He is a skeptic, and despite what you may believe, I'm something of a skeptic as well. And I think one of the reasons these books have found a mass appeal is that he is skeptical. He's diving into these conspiracy theories from the standpoint of somebody who doesn't believe them. And so you can be an intelligent reader and say, well, I'm sort of interested in this, but I really doubt it's real. And at every point, Langdon is right there with you doubting it's real.
Does Professor Langdon, does he get a new and different, very attractive woman, and perhaps intellectually gifted or descended from Mary Magdalene, whatever it might be, for every story? Or does, you know, is there ever going to be any permanence in this, in this man's life?
He is a blessed man in many ways, I guess.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's funny. I love building tension into novels, and certainly having a female traveling companion, there's always a romantic and sexual tension. Even if it's not on the page, it's implied. I love the idea of smart women. I find that very attractive. And obviously Langdon does too.
Super smart women in this case. I mean, you know, world-class noeticists.
Well, as I said, he's a fortunate guy.
Okay. In writing The Lost Symbol, did you begin with a whole schematic of puzzles that get solved, and building the puzzle first, and then writing the story around it? Does the puzzle get created as you go along with the story, or
it really depends on the puzzle and on the moment in the story. At least all of my novels begin with a big idea. And in this case, having written Angels and Demons, I'd studied some particle mm-hmm. physics and knew that there was this world of noetic science that was kind of out there. And it really had no relation to Angels and Demons, but I knew I wanted to come back to it. And in the 10 years that, between Angels and Demons and now, that field has exploded, and I became very, very interested with it. So that really is this idea of a science that's tied to these ancient mysteries, the old and the new. I love to tie together, and the codes, they serve a plot line.
In this book, Freemasonry figures, to say it figures prominently is an understatement. This book is about Freemasonry and Freemasons. What's your sensitivity to a group that, over the centuries, taken some pretty rough beatings for keeping its secrets? They were vilified by Hitler during his
sure.
day. How sensitive are you to Masonic sensibilities?
Oh. Highly sensitive. I mean, there's a point in the book where Langdon makes the point that misinterpreting people's symbols is often the root of prejudice. And part of what I hoped to do with this book is shed some light from my perspective on Masonic symbolism and Masonic ritual.
But Professor Langdon says, you know, don't read anything evil into Masonic secrets. But he's always being proven wrong all the time. The world is always much more mysterious than he says it is at first blush.
That is true, and that's one of the things that fascinates me about Freemasonry.
What is it that fascinates you about Freemasonry?
Well, you know, we live in a world where people kill each other every day over whose definition of God is correct. And here is a worldwide organization that at its core will bring people together from many, many different religions and ask only that you believe in a God, and they'll all stand in the same room and proclaim their reverence for a God. And it seems like a perfect blueprint for universal spirituality.
Well, on that note
of universal spirituality, that's it for this week.
You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I am Netta Ulibe.
And I'm Linda Holmes.
Thanks for listening to Culturetopia.